You're listening to 340B Unscripted.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to 340B Unscripted. My name's Greg. I'm here with my co-host, Rob the Hoopy. Hoopy, what's happening, man?
Not much. Yeah, we got a lot of stuff going on in 340B world. Some fun, you know, legal battles, draft legislation type stuff. Yeah. We also have a lot of HRSA audits. I think you and I are both participating in some HRSA audits right now and helping clients prep for those. So that's keeping us busy. So that's always fun.
Busy time of year, I think, right now. I feel like it's always busy. And I feel like when there's 340B developments, they happen in when it rains, it pours. It's a big cluster of them. We've got a couple of, we got a court case that's had a ruling that we're going to talk about. We've got some legislative proposals around contract pharmacy they've been waiting for. So all that happened in the span of last week. So lots for us to catch up on. Also, we're recording on the Monday after Selection Sunday for the NCAA March Madness tournament. I got a shout out to my alma mater, Duquesne University. They won the Atlantic 10 Conference this weekend, playing in the March Madness tournament for the first time since 1977. So 11 seed.
All right, but they're in. Yeah. They're not a 16 seed or playing.
They might have been bounced out by the time this actually posts on the Monday that it's supposed to air. So
11's not bad. They got a chance at 11. It's tough when you're like the 16th seed playing the first seed. And
15 seeds made it last year. So
true. That's true.
Got to pull. So if you're looking for an upset, well, you've already filled out your bracket probably now, but root for Duquesne if they're still in it by this point.
I haven't done a bracket yet. We normally do for our pharmacy division.
SpendMed, yeah, the company does one. We do a couple of different. We do brackets, and then everybody gets randomly assigned a team, I think.
You know what? Jake usually pushes that. I'm going to have to get on him about that tomorrow.
Yeah. Everybody's got to put their work down and fill out a bracket. That's the...
Yeah, we're too busy with work, Greg. We don't have time to fill out brackets.
All right. Let's start with updated contract pharmacy restrictions by manufacturers. Genentech, subsidiary of Roche, biggest manufacturer in the world, now manufacturer number 31. They plan to implement restrictions. They haven't posted a policy. I guess the policy notice will be posted on 340B ESP on April 1st. It's going to impact all of their products except a couple of specialty meds, Hemlibra, which is a hemophilic agent, and then a medication, oral medication for spinal muscular atrophy. So early on, when we started seeing these, Genentech's name got brought up in conversations, and I thought, well, a lot of Genentech's products, if not most that I recall, are bought through like buy and bill or hospital administered drug universes, not in the retail space. But I guess there's going to be some impact on the contract pharmacy side now.
My guess is, I don't know what you're seeing when you're out in the field talking to some of our clients, and it feels like the whole white bagging or clear bagging.
Yeah.
Seems to be coming back more, and almost like maybe PBMs or payers are noticing that, hey, if we go through a retail pharmacy adjudication process, maybe they don't have to pay as much, right? You don't get the markup and the administration fee. The retail side's a little bit more lower cost. So I wonder if we're seeing more of that. And so maybe that's what Genentech's seeing is, hey, we're getting more and more drugs going through contract pharmacies through white bagging processes. And so it's that could be a play.
Yeah. Well, I think we're running out of manufacturers. There's others out there, but the big ones are all accounted for. Roche and Genentech are huge in terms of,
I'm curious to know. Yeah, I must want to pay attention and see how many Genentech drugs come through the retail and contract pharmacy side and how big that impact is going to be, since it's all but those two drugs. And interesting, they excluded those two. I think you and I joked around and said, is it because those are almost always infusion, or, they're definitely more orphan type conditions, or at least, acute conditions that could be problematic if for saving. So, for whatever reason, they excluded those two, which is good. Better than nothing.
Yep. Yeah. All right. We'll talk probably more after we get a chance to see the full policy notice in an upcoming episode. But yeah, stay tuned. April 1st, you'll see a new Genentech 340B policy coming out.
Yeah, because it's unclear whether it's going to impact everybody. It does say there's some preliminary information about locations registered in on HRSA database. So that'd be all covered entities. So, but we should wait for clarification on that. And looks like they will allow for the single contract pharmacy exception. So pretty much that's all we kind of know. But yeah, let's wait. We can wait for a formal letter and all the details in there about, you know, health system exceptions and all that good stuff.
All right. On a related note, we've got an update to a pending court case impacting contract pharmacy law. So the big win for the 340B provider community. The Arkansas is one of two states that has enacted laws protecting contract pharmacy provisions for contract pharmacy. It's the Arkansas Act 1103 or 1103. This has been battled. There's been a battle regarding this in court. There was a unanimous decision last week through the U.S. Eighth Circuit Court in favor of the state of Arkansas, suggesting that the 340B law enacted by the state is not preempted by federal law. So Arkansas is going to begin enforcing the contract pharmacy provisions in their state law immediately. Pretty interesting case, huh, Rob?
It really is, right? I mean, because that was the big question. Can states actually enforce this? And that was the at least some manufacturer's stance, which is why they were kind of taking it to court just to confirm, okay, can states really do this? This is a federal program. Should states really be getting involved? So interesting. It's almost one of those, right? Since technically the statute's sort of silent on it, so which is why we have the issues in the first place, then that does mean that that opens up the door for states to enforce something that the federal law does not. So I think that seems to be the premise for what that case was saying, that state law can be in effect here. And so I think it's interesting. And then of course, shortly thereafter, right, then Arkansas, like you said, is planning on enforcing it.
Yeah.
So I think they're sending letters to what, 14 drug makers, either this week, I think is, because I think I saw the report last week. So I think this week, those 14 drug manufacturers who haven't said anything about complying are going to get letters from Arkansas for enforcement. So yeah,
this, and the thought is now too, you're going to see just a swell of additional complaints against manufacturers. So Arkansas Insurance Department is probably going to be pretty busy. I highlighted a couple of kind of passages out of the court ruling. One is, you know, the ruling noted that the PHS statute addresses wholesalers, but it is silent regarding the delivery of drugs to patients. So the judges that made this ruling said, you know, because Congress did not legislate the issue of pharmacy distribution, that indicates that 340B law is not intended to be preempted. And they also described, look, federal government has traditionally allowed and regarded state law as complementary with regard to drug regulation, and that the state law offers an additional important layer of consumer protection with regard to federal drug regulation. So, you know, essentially saying, look, the state isn't operating outside its boundaries by establishing some laws that address the use of 340B drugs. So really, really interesting. Greases the skids for more momentum. You know, we've seen a number of states already introduce contract pharmacy laws. We've got 15 states that have something introduced. Five states have introduced and passed laws through at least one chamber of their state legislature. And then we've got the two states, Arkansas and Louisiana, that have enacted their laws. So this is going to be the big play, I think, for a lot of folks out there advocating for 340B providers.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it looks like, I think as an update, or recently, at least on Friday, Mississippi now, the House just passed the contract pharmacy bill 2 days after the Senate passed a similar bill. So Mississippi looks like they're the next one through.
Yeah.
Out of those five that now have both chambers.
Yeah. You know, we got, you know, I don't know if this is going to change how manufacturers are approaching their restrictions nationwide, but in Arkansas, we've got 9 manufacturers that have exempted Arkansas covered entities from the restrictions. You got to imagine that there might be more manufacturers, at least in Arkansas and Louisiana, where these states have passed laws, they're going to back off of some of the restrictions. So we might really start to see some of the benefit of legislating this through at the state level.
Yeah. Well, the 14 that get letters will probably definitely back off.
Now, a question I have for you is, we've seen, not only have we seen states take up you know, the task of drafting contract pharmacy laws, but we've got some states out there that have passed laws to address the need for 340B transparency or reporting requirements for covered entities. We've got three states that have passed laws, two states that have introduced bills. Minnesota's, you know, there's been a lot of chat around the Minnesota 340B reporting requirements. Those are effective April 1. So covered entities in Minnesota need to start submitting data to the state in, by April 1st. Do you think this opens up or will provoke other states to say, hey, look, 340B reporting requirements aren't addressed in the statute. Let's create state level laws so that we have visibility into at least the covered entities in our states. Do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah. I mean, here's the hard part, right? And I'm sure we'll talk about it as we get into some additional legislation. But the hard part is, you know, the Sustained 340B Act and other legislation at a federal level is already trying to address that. But I think I agree with you, right? I think most states are looking at this going, okay, re-election year, are we really getting anything through the House? I'm sure we're going to discuss this as we get into the other, the federal bills. But I think you're right. I think some states are like, we're not going to wait for the feds. If the feds pass a bill, great. In the meantime, yeah, we're going to take things into our own hands. So I agree with you. I think we're going to see many more states go after contract farms restrictions, but at the same time, simultaneously see some additional states, maybe not as many, but yeah, more states look at transparency. I do think that's going to happen as well.
I don't know. Maybe personally, I don't hate that idea. The reporting requirements can't be onerous. They need to be practical, but
yeah,
I don't see a lot of harm in establishing some degree of transparency process as a, you know, a bargaining chip to, you know, also protect covered entities and the access that they need to 340B price drugs. So
yeah. Yeah.
Maybe I'm in the minority there, but you know, I think that seems like a practical, I think you've said an olive branch to offer up as we try to, you know, negotiate some 340B program reform.
Right. It's not any restrictions. It's, you're just simply saying, hey, here's our savings. And most, I mean, almost all of the covered ends we work with, well, grantees for sure, but many of the hospitals, their charity care is through the roof. It's,
yeah,
you would think with, you know, different healthcare options out there that it wouldn't be, but it still seems to be very high, right? A lot of people unemployed or in between or underinsured just can't make ends meet with inflation, all these things. So we just seem to still see a high amount of charity care or financial assistance being provided that for most of our clients often dwarfs their 340B savings. Not in all cases, but in many, many cases, it dwarfs it. And hospitals are still running in the red, trying to keep doors open. And yeah, I don't know, it just seems interesting that people are so worried about it. It's like, but the hospital just lost millions of dollars and you're worried about, you know, what they're doing with their savings.
Right.
I think they're just trying to keep people employed right now.
Yeah, just trying to keep the lights on. All right, let's move on. Get into some of the updates with regard to federal legislation. So we've talked here before, Rob, of the Sustain Act, Sustain 340B Act. There's an RFI. I know we're working on drafting our response to the request for information. That's due April 1st. Lots of considerations being put forth in that proposal. We now have a bill being introduced in the House. Representative Doris Matsui from California. We've been talking about this for a while. There's a lot of fanfare around this back at the Summer Coalition last July. 340B Patients Act has been introduced. It's a proposed amendment to the PHS statute that would codify contract pharmacy provisions. Big win again for covered entities, or something covered entities have been hoping for a long time now.
Yeah. Excited. You know, and I've said on this podcast, Representative Matsui is one of my favorite representatives. I really like her a lot. And yeah, this one took a while. I think, you know, reading through some of the information, she was looking for a co-sponsor across the aisle, which is why she didn't introduce it last year trying to do that. But putting it forward, and, you know, it'll be interesting. The fact that it's getting, you know, our concern last time was, you know, is it going to be able to make it to the energy, the and commerce committee, subcommittee on health.
Yep.
So you know, she's getting some movement. So I'm excited for that. And I think this is necessary because, remember, for everyone, it's the House is right now is Republican controlled. And so if she can get some airtime with this bill, I think that's a positive movement for where it's at.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll see how this plays out. But, you know, good timing as well, because there is this component, this contract pharmacy manufacturer restrictions component in the Sustained 340B Act on the Senate side, which of course is narrowly controlled by the Democratic side. And so I think they're going to have an easier time getting it through. But my concern has always been what happens when that bill, providing the Senate gets it through, comes over to the House. And of course, now the House, you know, the entire House is up for re-election, right? They get, unlike the Senate, where only a third is, entire House is up for re-election. It's a re-election year. There's only so many things they can try and get done before they all get busy on their re-election campaigns. And so some concerns about whether the Senate bill is going to make it through this year. And so I think it's helpful that Representative Matsui's bill is there to at least cover that component of it. I think that'll make it easier.
Yeah. Just kind of recap some of the elements in the 340B Patients Act. So again, it's proposing that manufacturers be required to offer 340B priced drugs to covered entities, regardless of the manner or location in which a drug is dispensed. So no conditions or limitations on the use of contract pharmacies. It's going to bar manufacturers from implementing conditions or putting restrictions like we're dealing with now. And for manufacturers that violate the law, it will impose civil monetary penalties. Really steep penalty if you're violating this proposed bill, Rob. $2 million maximum per day if you're in violation of the law. It's a really steep penalty, huh?
That's pricey. Yes. I'd call that a big stick.
Yeah.
Definitely don't want to get hit by it if you're a manufacturer. That's
big deterrent,
sure.
Right. So a couple of questions that I wanted to ask you. You already addressed the ones, what the legislative path looks like for this bill. There's probably a really big uphill climb for any legislation to move through now as we head into a general election year. But how do you think this proposal might impact limited distribution drugs? So the Matsui's draft bill really, is very, I think, heavy-handed in saying, look, manufacturers cannot avoid selling 340B priced drugs to covered entities under any means. There may be drugs out there that covered entities today can't access through limited distribution channels. Do you think that becomes, the use of limited distribution mechanisms for getting your drugs out in the marketplace? Do you think there's going to be impact on LDD supply chain?
Yeah, it's a good question, right? Depends, how this the rules are written around this legislation, providing it passes. Because I mean, right now, I like to think of it. I've always thought of limited distribution. If you had access before, right? So that means you're, as a provider, hospital, clinic, whatever you are. If you have access to that limited distribution drugs, sometimes there's REMS programs, there's other things you have to fulfill, right? You have to make sure that you can monitor the patients and do all these things. And a lot of that's handled through a specialty pharmacy with a pharmacist who fulfill that role as part of that specialty pharmacy, right? And that's why you have URAC accreditation, all these things, so that they can meet those requirements. Or sometimes the manufacturer picks one specialty pharmacy who gets special training and making sure that the drugs, REMS or LDD, whatever components they need to make sure it's safe for use and that these things are checked, whether it's pregnancy exams or cardiac exams or whatever, lab tests or whatever needs to be done, all those things are done. Yeah. And so I always tell people, if you had access before, then you should have access today. So, right. So at least the bill would make sure that happens. But you're right. It is curious. But what if you don't have access today? Could something like this be used to say, hey, you have to provide me access?
Yeah.
Whether it's, there's a safety question, right? So I think it gets a little messy.
Yeah.
I would have to believe it's going to be the one way, though, that if you have access to, any account type, then you should have access to 340B.
Or if, manufacturers are looking to, again, mitigate the financial loss of selling drugs through a 340B priced contract pharmacy channel, do they look at drugs that are being developed and through their FDA approval process, do they pitch for a REMS so that perhaps the drug can be, distributed by, a single contract or a single limited distribution pharmacy that would not be able to contract with covered entities. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think what the long-term mitigation strategies would be from pharmaceutical manufacturers is they're looking to try to avoid having to pony up sales of 340B drugs through contract pharmacy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think definitely paying attention to this one and how the rules and how.
Yeah.
Far-reaching it gets, it will be critical.
Let's see. Other updates. We've got an ongoing lawsuit. It's an open litigation. Cohort of 44 health systems sued HRSA at the end of the 2023 year regarding the child site eligibility guidance that was published in, October 26th, 27th, 2023. HRSA filed a 51-page motion this past week, arguing for the lawsuit to be dismissed, saying it's opportunistic. And I think the quote from 340B report that came out of the brief is no good deed. What was the saying?
I'll try to fight it too. Yeah. Normally it's no good deed goes unpunished is what I always tell people, but no good deed goes unpunished. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Because they said it's an opportunistic challenge to HRSA's decision to relax 340B hospital registration policy in response to exigency. I didn't even say that word during the PHE. Plaintiffs now seek to use HRSA's emergency response as a springboard to challenge 340B registration requirements. Okay. First, I want to just say, I really appreciate HRSA. They do a lot of good things. They really try and work with covered entities. But if I can say in this case, I got to call BS on this one. You can't say no good deed goes unpunished and that we did this for during the emergency because for 3 years you told us that it was going to last into perpetuity and it wasn't really the COVID. If that was said at the beginning, right? If they said, hey, we're going to allow for this. It's only for the COVID PHE. When the COVID PHE ends, it's going to stop. That would be one thing. That means no good deed goes unpunished when it ends and we say, oh, you shouldn't have ended it because they were clear from the beginning. It's a little different if you, for 3 years, you basically let everyone, you say so, and then let everyone believe that it's going to go on in perpetuity. And then days before the COVID PHE ends, you change your mind.
Yeah.
There's just some intellectual dishonesty in that statement. And again, HRSA does such a good job with what they've been given, how hard the program is to manage, managing both the manufacturer side and the covered entity side. So they really do a good job. It's just in this case, the ball got dropped. I'm sorry, but there's no better, really good way to say it other than the ball got dropped because any federal agency that says one thing for 3 years and changes your mind 3 days prior to the change is going to get pushback. Like that's like a no brainer. Like that's something you don't do as a federal agency. It's going to get challenged. So they shouldn't be surprised. And I just think, no good deed goes unpunished. If that was your intent, the communication got dropped then because that's not the communication we had.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this lawsuit progresses. And don't forget, as part of the Sustain 340B Act, there is, some debate around what might be more practical measures for identifying outpatient hospital departments and their eligibility under 340B program. I know we've talked about it, and the RFI kind of implies provider-based rules established by CMS may be a more reasonable measure for determining an offsite location's eligibility under the 340B program, as opposed to, the Medicare cost report and the need for the location to be registered on OPACE. Again, I think HRSA got it right when they published FAQ 4301, a way more pragmatic mechanism for defining child site eligibility. Clearly, the folks that the gang of six that drafted the Sustain 340B Act also recognize that maybe there's a better way to define child site eligibility moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. But I do, again, I mean, I know we've said it before, but just in case people haven't heard it before, one of the lawyers we work with, I didn't get permission to share that person said it, but it brought up a good argument. Or maybe it was on the podcast. Maybe I can. You have to remind me. But that CMS, so Medicare, when you add a new location, immediately considers it location eligible and reimburses you as a provider-based department, right? And they're typically using the NPI of the hospital. So this becomes extremely problematic when HRSA doesn't allow this location to be 340B eligible. Especially if you think about carving in Medicaid and it states that require you to bill at AAC and you're using the hospital's NPI, it gets really, really challenging because you're not buying the drugs on 340B, right? And now the states are pushing back saying, well, we can't seek a rebate or because we're an NPI only state, so all drugs are included. I mean, it gets really messy really fast. And so to me, it makes sense that as soon as CMS, which since you're basing everything on the Medicare cost report, considers that new location eligible, then it should be eligible for 340B. Right. And I think then the onus does become on the covered entity. If they screwed up and included a site that's really not going to be provider based, then, not only should they pay back CMS the difference for any differential they receive for that increased payment on their visits, but they should probably also pay back that 340B savings. So there's to me already, compliance elements that would keep hospitals in check if they erroneously considered a location qualified. Not to mention, I think there could be a process put in place as, okay, if you use this immediately, then, especially if you get audited, there's going to be a secondary check when that next cost report comes out to ensure that it is in fact qualified location. So we have all that in place. I just think it's it's crazy that we're going to say we're going to use CMS as Medicare cost report, but not in this case.
Yeah. So I think that was, so if you haven't been listening to the podcast, if you go back to episodes 27, 28, we had Emily Cook on. She's an attorney from McDermott. And I believe they're leading the litigation against HRSA regarding this child site guidance. So I doubt Emily's able to come back on and share additional insights. But yeah, she had great thoughts around the practicality of using CMS provider-based rules for defining 340B location eligibility. So go back and listen to our episodes 27 and 28 if you want to get her take on this.
Good. I couldn't remember if I talked to her just on the side or on the podcast. So I was like, oh, I'm just coming up with this on the fly because we are unscripted, everybody. And I didn't want to, especially knowing that she was part of that law case. I was like, yeah, I'm gonna play it safe. I'm glad you remember or checked.
All right. I think that's it. Any other news or developments, Rob, you want to talk about before we skip out of here?
Well, other than you mentioned Sustained 340B Act, it's, you know, by the time this podcast comes out, we'll probably be close to April 1st. So hopefully everyone's been able to get their comments in. That's critical. Other than that, I'm trying to think of anything else that's critical that's come out. I just think right now, just, you know, pay attention to what's out there. If you have the opportunity to talk to your representatives, there's so much going on. There is a chance. So I think that, you know, advocacy is still critical right now. And I guess the last thing I'd say, you know, HRSA's keeping up those HRSA audits. So make sure your HRSA audit ready. And, yep. And you know, if you have annual independent audits, the one thing else is make sure that you're looking at those reports and implementing as much as you can. It's hard when I feel like we work with a covered entity and identify an issue, and just because they're so busy, they don't implement, and then we get the HRSA audit letter and now we're scrambling. So That's the one thing I've been seeing lately. I would say the couple of covered entities I'm working with recently have done a fantastic job of implementing. So it's made the HRSA audit process so much better, because it's the first thing. Okay, remember this report, we're supposed to get these registrations. Oh yeah, we did that. We have these MPIs, we have these bill to ship system. Okay, perfect. Yeah. Just collecting data and it's going pretty smooth.
Yeah. Yeah, that, and then, you know, making sure you have a chance to go through the HRSA data request list and make sure you're prepared to provide all that data. They make that DRL publicly available. We've talked about it on the podcast. We've got that ongoing series. So, you know, a lot of things that you can do today, you know, before you ever get a HRSA audit notice, that make sure that you're ready when the time comes, because you are not going to have a lot of time to pull all of those different data elements together. So an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So.
I will say, we have a couple more DRL items left. I think we should be able to finish it up in one more episode, right?
Yeah, I think we've got number 8, which is self-disclosure documentation. A lot of covered entities don't have anything for that one. And then 9's a relatively big one. A lot of new items, Medicaid billing details. So.
Yeah, there's quite a bit in there. Yeah, so one more episode. We should be able to wrap that up.
But one more for us, and then some of the folks from our grantee pods. So Heidi and Megan and Jasmine, I think, are going to come on here and talk about some grantee-specific considerations around responding to the DRL. A lot of the data elements are the same, but they've got some pearls of wisdom from working with grantee providers. So you and I will get one more shot to wrap it up, and then they'll come on and add some of their own insights working with the grantee-covered entities.
Are you telling me we're going to hand over the reins of the podcast?
We are. We're going to deviate from the formula a little bit, but...
I'm sure they'll do a fantastic job.
Those ladies know what they're talking about, so it'll be a good one.
Okay.
All right, Rob.
About the peanut gallery. I like it.
Yeah. All right. It was good catching up with you.
Same, Greg. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll catch you later. Again, if you have topics that you want us to chat about, or if you have any comments on things we discuss, email us at 340bunscripted@spendmen.com. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to 340B Unscripted. Subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.